This is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Gene Purcell. 46 years ago, Otis Redding lost his life in Madison, and few events loom as large in city lore. Writer Dean Robbins shares how Redding touched his life.
Sitting in the morning sun.
Otis Redding has a connection to Wisconsin, but it's a sad one. In 1967, the 26-year-old rhythm and blues singer died in Madison's Lake Monona. His plane crashed en route to a concert here. Madison has not taken this piece of music history lightly. The city built a monument to Redding by the lake, and local media retell the story of his crash every year on December 10th. But I have a happier story to tell about Otis Redding. It's a story about his music touching a child 3 decades after his death. The child is my son. Right after his birth, I wanted to make sure he had a feeling for music. None of my child-rearing books covered this topic, so I had to improvise. The solution I hit on was Otis Redding. There is nothing more soulful.
You know she's waiting. Just anticipating.
I decided to play Redding's irresistible songs for my newborn every day for the first year of his life. If that didn't hardwire music into his brain, nothing would. I began a steady diet of hits, like Respect and Sittin' on the Dock of the Bay. The song he responded to most, for some reason, was the little-known Loving by the Pound. He giggled and wriggled in my arms as I danced him around the room. Can an early dose of Otis Redding really teach a child to love music? All I can say is, my homemade experiment worked. Even in elementary school, my son responded to a wide range of musical styles. He picked up the guitar, too. I give all credit to Otis. When my son got old enough, I faced a difficult task. I had to tell him the story of Redding's life, complete with its tragic end in our hometown. Otis, I explained, was a prodigy from Georgia who recorded his first single with the Stax label at age 21. He moved audiences around the world with his raw, emotional performances. Otis sang about love more powerfully than any American singer of his era. Indeed, he made his most lasting impression during 1967's Summer of Love at the Monterey Music Festival. A half year later, he decided to go ahead with his flight to Madison, despite dangerous rain and fog. He didn't want to let down his local fans by canceling the show. And that, unfortunately, is the end of the Otis Redding story. But I don't want my son to obsess about what happened on December 10th, 1967. When he thinks about Otis Redding, I want him to think about love, Loving by the Pound.
I've got dreams, to remember.
Dean Robbins is the editor of Isthmus, Madison's alternative weekly.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Joining us now is Craig Werner. He's a professor in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison. He's here to talk about the musical influence of Otis Redding. Craig, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be talking.
Well, in terms of Otis Redding's career, where was he at this point in 1967? How popular was he?
Otis had made a breakthrough in about the 6 months prior to his death. Weirdly enough, he never had a top 20 single during his lifetime, but his message had begun to spread rapidly, both through his appearance at Monterey, which was legendary, and the fact that he had written Aretha Franklin's anthem, Respect. And he was on the cusp, I think, of absolute superstardom.
And he was on that cusp. What are the elements, you know, for people who may not be as familiar with his music as others, what were the elements that brought him to that cusp and really started sort of expanding his influence beyond just the traditional, you know, what they used to call the Chitlin Circuit?
Yeah, there were two things that Otis did. Number one is he brought a really deep Southern gospel singing style into soul music. And when I say soul music, I really mean the soul music that was crossing over to a white audience at the time, which had been prepared by Motown and Sam Cooke. And Otis really kept it in church. And the singing style, the grit, the soul, the emotional depth and complexity was beginning to speak to white audiences. And then secondly, because he was at Monterey with Jimi Hendrix, with The Who, with many of the biggest stars of rock and roll, the spotlight was on him. And he responded to rock, not just in his performing, but also in his songwriting. Dock of the Bay was in part a response to what the Beatles were doing with Sgt. Pepper.
And they responded. I mean, I want to return to that Monterey thing for a second here, because that was such a big game changer. He responded to the audience, and the audience responded to him, and that, you know, as we sit here 46 years down the road, that doesn't sound like that big a deal, but that was a game changer.
It really was. I mean, there's no way to say it that doesn't sound like a cliche, but it was the summer of love, and he just radiated that energy to the audience, and the audience radiated it back to him. There's a great spoken introduction to Try a Little Tenderness that he performed there. That just, he says, this is the love crowd, right? And he gets this roar of response from them. And that call and response is what the Black Church was all about, and it felt absolutely natural.
I was reading about his life and how he had plenty of gigs lined up for 1968 that I can imagine hundreds, if not thousands, of people were looking forward to being there to see him live. And then, of course, he died in that untimely plane crash. What do you think would have happened if Otis hadn't died in that accident and he was able to continue on with his career?
It's obviously speculating, but I think that Otis Redding, like Sam Cooke before him, had the capability and the vision to affect a kind of racial reconciliation, that his bringing black and white audiences together was something that was very, very unusual at the time. Stevie Wonder would do it a little bit later, but I think that Otis really was at a position where, at a time that black power was rising, there were riots in the cities, that racial tension was a part of the everyday news, he was bringing people together, and I think that he had the potential to spread that even more broadly.
And of course, we know a lot about Otis Redding as a musician, as a lot of historians go back and try to celebrate his career. But what do we know about him as a person?
Well, as a person, Otis Redding just seemed to be a beloved. I mean, the love that was in his songs really seems to have been a part of the way people responded to him everywhere. Everyone liked him. That's what soul music is about. It's sincere, it's authentic, it's real, and he was all of those things.
So we should talk about the accident and the plane crash, because that is such a big part of Madison, of the city of Madison. It was early 1967, or late 1967, I guess, December, and Otis Redding had his own plane, as I understand it, and the band was traveling on it. They were in some bad weather, and they crashed. They didn't make it.
Yeah, and there's never really been any clear notion of what happened with that. There are always rumors, but to the best of my knowledge, just the plane went down. You know, I live right across from the lake, and, you know, I see it every morning. And bad weather, bad luck, maybe a bad decision to travel in it. The thing that always strikes me as most saddest about it is that Otis, after Madison, was going to go back into the studio and finish Dock of the Bay. The whistling verse, which is just amazing and wonderful, was simply there as a placeholder. He was planning on writing another verse and taking that out. And Otis almost certainly never heard the completed record.
And he recorded that, what, just like 3 or 4 days before he died?
Yeah, right before he died. He was in the studio and he was going back in.
And so the aftermath of his death, it meant bad news for a whole bunch of folks, but it also meant some bad news for Stax Records, for the label that he was associated with.
Yeah, because Stax Records had a distribution agreement with Atlantic Records out of New York, and it was up for renegotiation at that point. And from the perspective of Atlantic Records, Otis Redding was the whole show at Stax at that point. I think that wasn't a very good judgment on their part. But after Otis's death, those negotiations fell apart, and Stax really went into a dive. It was to recover a few years later, but it was devastating for Stax, and the loss of the Barquets, the musicians who were with him, a great, great soul band.
Can you think of any examples today that we can listen for and still hear Otis Redding's influence in music?
Yeah, the singer that I would go to on that is a guy named Charles Bradley. And Bradley is recording with the Daptone label, which does a lot of kind of really funky soul music that sounds like it could have been recorded yesterday. And Charles Bradley particularly sounds, to my ears, like Otis Redding's spirit and voice has been channeled into the contemporary world. R&B generally, soul music generally, is much more highly produced, but Otis, with the great backing musicians that he had at Stax, really lets the voice carry it, and I do think there's some of that going on today.
Yeah, I wanted to tie in on that. You mentioned Daptone and some of the recordings that are going on there, and right now there seems to be kind of a resurgence of that soul sound. I mean, if Otis were alive now, do you think he'd kind of feel at home to a certain extent in some of these studios?
Well, I think if Otis was alive now, he'd be doing something amazingly creative and different. But sure, he could go into the Daptone studio and record his great songs without blinking. No question.
In our last minute here, why don't you give us a recommendation for maybe one of his lesser known songs and why you think it's worth checking out?
Hard to Handle is the one I would go to. Otis was both a great singer and a good songwriter. He didn't write a lot of songs, but the ones he did were amazing, and Hard to Handle is one. And then there's one called Ton of Joy, which he didn't write, but it's just, to my mind, one of the most gorgeous Southern soul songs you'll ever hear. Wonderful guitar introduction by Steve Cropper, who seemed to be absolutely in sync with Otis all the time. Steve Cropper, great Memphis guitarist.
Well, thanks for those recommendations. Craig Werner, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Craig Werner, professor in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison, talking about the life and legacy of Otis Redding.